If I said to you, this week at work will be a bit different. You'll only work 4 days, but you'll still get paid for 5. What would you say? The 4-day week is seen as a radical proposal in Australia, but it's a key plank of UK Labour's election platform, and it's been trialled by some big corporations. So if you could convert your full-time job to a 4-day week, would you? How do you think that would affect your life? I'd love to hear your thoughts on our Facebook page. Those in favour of the 4-day week say it lifts productivity and worker satisfaction and can even reduce gender inequality. But its critics say it's unworkable and could even damage our work-life balance. Let's work through some of those arguments. Emma Dawson is the executive director of a progressive independent think tank called Per Capita, which focuses on reducing inequality in Australia. Emma, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Hilary. Great to be with you.
So how would this work? Would it mean businesses paying people for 5 days but only getting 4 days of labour?
That's commonly how it's understood, but actually that's a critical issue in the whole debate. Is you've got to stop thinking about paying people for time and start thinking about paying people for output or productivity. So essentially, yes, the idea behind it is that people would move to a shorter working week, and whether that was 4 7.5 or 8 hour days or 5 6 hour days, it works best if people are allowed to do that flexibly, without a reduction in salary or income. But critically, the important thing is for employers then to think about, well, the job is the job and I need to get the same amount of productivity out of that worker over four days instead of 5. So it's about thinking differently about how we measure output.
And I've just got an image now of an employer standing there with a whip cracking it over your desk if they're wanting the same amount of work in 4 days they would usually get in 5. Could it backfire for workers?
Look, all the evidence shows that it doesn't. Where it's been tried, people's productivity actually goes up because they have a better work-life balance. They don't waste time at work. There's a lot of evidence to show that we're really only productive for about 4 hours a day anyway.
Wow.
A lot of the additional time spent chatting at the coffee machine or going on Facebook. And of course, that's the typical office worker. There are different outcomes for different roles. But effectively, any working mother, Hilary, and I believe you are one, as am I, would tell you that going back to work part-time after having children often means you're still doing the same amount of work in shorter hours anyway. You're just getting paid less. So there's a lot of evidence to show that there can be productivity at the same level, even increased, if people are given that opportunity to have a better work-life balance.
And Emma, one of the places that tried it said that the employees actually worked out ways to be more efficient, so things yeah. like automating manual processes, but also reducing non-work-related internet usage.
That's right.
Could we just be a bit more productive with the time that we have and not just have 4 productive hours a day? I mean, that's outrageous.
Well, we could be, but I think one of the challenges here is one of the reasons people are doing non-work related internet activity at work is because they don't have enough time to manage their non-working lives. So you'll jump on the internet while you're at work and do your online banking, or perhaps do online shopping, or arrange a kid's birthday party, send out invitations to your parents' 80th on the weekend. If you have that time back for your own time, then the division between work, paid work time, and unpaid work time, domestic labour time, is much more clearly delineated. The fact that people are doing that in their working hours, are having to take care of all of their domestic tasks and domestic labour during working hours, I think is a really strong indicator that we've got the balance wrong and there's not enough time for people to take care of their non-paid work commitments when we're all working, 40 hours a week, raising kids, 2-parent families. It's a constant struggle.
Emma Dawson, tell me about some of the concrete examples where it's been trialled. Microsoft did it for a month in Japan, and Perpetual Guardian, a big financial services company in New Zealand. What happened in those instances?
So Perpetual Guardian in particular in New Zealand is a really interesting case because they trialled it and after the trial they found it to be a stunning success. Not only were workers happier, but they found productivity remained the same or even increased slightly across the business as a whole. They had employees taking less sick leave, as we've just talked about, employees doing less personal business on company time, finding much more efficient ways of working. Overall, it was generally considered to be so successful that they decided to make it a permanent situation. And the longer term, when we've seen this trialled in different businesses, and there's one actually in Australia, in Canberra, a creative agency called IceLab that does a four-day week, and they've also found that over time, employee turnover goes down. Employees tend to stick with the company a lot longer because they feel valued and they feel that they have that work-life balance. So there are benefits there in terms of the costs of staff recruitment, staff training, and retaining that corporate memory in the organisation as well. That's not to say it isn't without challenges. Some businesses are structured in a way that makes it difficult. Businesses like law firms, for example, where they run on billable hours, there are some roles that it's quite challenging to think about how do we measure productivity in output rather than time. Obviously, shift workers, the customer facing roles where shops are open for 60 hours a week, they have to be staffed. Hospitals, schools, kids go to school for more than 4 days a week. But there are ways around that if we think about how we can share more jobs, share the work amongst more people. The HILDA survey found a couple of years ago in Australia, which is the longest longitudinal study of household and labour dynamics in Australia, that about one in five Australians would like to work fewer hours than they currently do. And we know that with the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate at the moment, we also have one in five Australians that would like more hours. So it seems a pretty good way, actually, of rebalancing the dynamics of our labour force.
A question via text message, Emma Dawson. What literature are you referring to when you say that we are only productive for 4 hours a day in the average office job?
Look, I'm going to have to take that on notice. It was a study published that came out of the US, and I think it was either in Harvard or Yale, and it was quite controversial at the time. And it was on average, obviously, but it was showing that, and productivity measured in terms of real productive output. That's not to say people aren't working more than 4 hours a day, but that their productivity goes down after a certain period of time because of fatigue and distraction with their other commitments.
We're talking with Emma Dawson, the Executive Director of the independent think tank Per Capita, and we'd love to hear what you think about this idea. Would you work 4 days a week or shorter days over five, perhaps, if that was an option, but for the same pay? And how do you think that would affect your life? You can share your thoughts and join the discussion on our Facebook page. Let's hear another perspective too. Professor Peter McElveen is from the School of Education at the University of Southern Queensland, and he leads the Australian Collaborative for Career Employability and Learning for Living. He's researched the psychology of working. Peter, welcome to Life Matters.
Good to be with you.
Now, the work world has changed a lot since the 40-hour work week came in. It's much less industrial for many of us in Australia and much more information-based. Do we really need a five-day work week for a lot of people these days?
I think the four-day work week is very tempting. I mean, who wouldn't want it? But for me, the real question is that how do people balance what they have to do at work now with what they have to do at home? So that work-life balance is very important. And so I think the key question that we need to put forward from a psychological perspective is how are people going to draw the psychological boundaries between what is work and what is not work, and when I'm on and when I'm switched off? That's going to be an important thing to manage.
So are you saying that would be harder to manage in a four-day week, or that is a roadblock to us changing our working habits at all?
Well, it's going to be difficult from the perspective of the worker and also from the employer. How the boundaries are set is really a personal matter for the worker and also a managerial matter for the organisation. But there are some people who are very, very conscientious workers. They will work 24 hours a day if you let them. Is that a good thing? I don't think so. We know that overwork is the cause of depression, anxiety, and all sorts of other health-related diseases and social problems. So if we're going to create a situation where people are saying, okay, yes, you can do all of your work within this shorter period of time, what is going to happen to those people who are absolutely committed or perhaps overcommitted to the work that they do now? How will they draw the psychological boundaries around what is home life and what is not?
And that's, I guess, if that's a problem we're dealing with now, and we would also be dealing with it in a four-day week, could it help in a sense because people have that extra day to not let work bleed into? They've got that extra day to do the life admin things that they might otherwise be forced to do at work, as Emma mentioned before.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I mean, how do we do that in practice? Let's think about one of the current problems that we have in workplaces now. We often rely on email extensively. And it's very easy to pick up your iPhone and just tap on the email icon when you're at home, when you perhaps should be cooking your meals or spending time with your family. It's just so easy to break that psychological boundary. You might be thinking, oh, look, I've got 50 emails I need to deal with before tomorrow. But the research shows that if people are working outside of their standard work hours, they go to work the next day already exhausted. So that becomes a cycle. So that's why we need to think very carefully about, when do I actually stop the clock psychologically? And there's some very interesting research around how people check their emails. And if you allow people to have their email open all day versus only having access to email, say, twice or three times per day, the level of stress is much lower in restricted access. So that tells us if we set some boundaries around when we're on and when we're off, we can actually start to manage stress in our workers a whole lot better.
And Peter, you've done some work on what the changes that have already happened in the employment landscape that do result in staff being happier and more productive employees. What did you find?
There's a link between this notion of job satisfaction, you know, basically that you enjoy your job. And then there's this other concept of work engagement, where it's the actual work that you're doing. It's the skills, the tasks that you're putting into action. So you've got your overall job satisfaction, and then you've got your work engagement. What are the things that drive those two psychological states of being? Because it's those two things that make people more productive at work. And our research has shown that it's just not necessarily how much money a person earns that encourages them to enjoy their job and stay in their job. There are other factors about related to their relationships at work and how well they get along with people. This is not rocket science. It's fairly basic stuff, but often it gets missed when we're thinking about what makes people happy and productive in their jobs. Just that basic sense of having control over your work, a sense of autonomy over your work, to be able to implement things according to your own professional judgment. That's a really important driver of a person's work engagement and job satisfaction. But that can be taken away very easily if you're spending too much time, say, on administrative tasks that aren't central to being actually productive in your professional job.
Peter, when I was reading up for this story, I found two really interesting aspects to it. Older workers often say that they would like to work for longer in their life, but the physical work schedules can be too demanding. And younger workers say that they're extremely keen to have more work-life balance, and that's something they look for when they're looking for jobs. Could this work at either end of the age spectrum? Could it help ease the transition into retirement for older people? And could it be an attractive thing that employers could use to retain staff into the future?
I think there's value in that idea, because when you think about a person over their lifespan, they have different needs at different points in time. Yes, younger people have much stronger, faster bodies than some of us at the other end of the working spectrum. Yes, so if we can think about what are the psychological resources that people can bring at different points in time in their life, whether it's a long-term perspective from young workers to older workers, or those ordinary fluctuations that we might go through, say in our 30s when we're thinking more about getting into the mortgage, getting a family, those sorts of mainstream typical life stages that people go through, they're going to have different psychological resources at that time. So I think the question's really fascinating. How can we make it work for people at the best point across their working life?
And Peter, another question for you. I think that some people report stigma when they take up flexible work options and job sharing options. Does that stigma lessen? And do you feel like that might be how it would play out if people took up the 4-day week option if it were available?
I think that's going to be something for an organisation to answer with respect to its culture and its values and how it sets itself out as a place to work for people. If you have an organisation where the culture is, look, everyone has to work really hard and doing a little bit of overtime is just the way we do it around here, I think that sets up expectations for people to starting to feel that stigma, to feel that sense that they're letting their colleagues down. And from the other point of view, if their colleagues are thinking that, well, we all have this expectation, they too are probably going to get into that situation of thinking, you know, oh, come on, you're letting the team down.
Emma Dawson, how likely would a four-day week be politically in Australia? It seems like such a big cultural shift for us, as Peter outlined.
It is a big cultural shift. I mean, Australians currently work some of the longest hours in the world, and I don't think either of the major parties are on board with this yet, although it's something the Greens ran up the flagpole a couple of years ago as saying it's worth talking about. But there's a shift towards it around the world. We've seen lots of companies in the UK now start to adopt it. There are companies here in Australia, as I said, that are experimenting with it. And like all social change and all changes in the labour force, the change will come from the movement of people to get behind an idea. So if you think about how we got the eight-hour day in the first place, it was, you know, over 160 years ago in Melbourne was the first instance of our stonemasons downing tools and demanding a shorter working week for the same pay, and they got it long before even Karl Marx started talking about the eight-hour day.
Well, on that, I haven't heard the unions speaking up in favour of a four-day working week yet.
I think there's some interest in amongst certain union officials around the country. It's certainly not something they're campaigning on strongly, but there are conversations going on in circles, certainly with researchers and policy thinkers in the Labor movement. And look, there was some research that came out of the New Economics Foundation in the UK recently. Their analysis suggested that if average hours of worker continue to fall in line with the post-World War II trend from sort of 1946 to the 1980, we'd currently have an average full-time working week of around 34 hours, and we'd be on track for a 30-hour week by 2040. So actually working hours did fall considerably over the last, you know, between kind of at the 1850s and 1980s through the efforts of the trade unions movement, advocating for better conditions, better hours, better work-life balance for their members. So we have to ask, why did that stop? Because it's actually 90 years ago that John Maynard Keynes said by now we'd all be working about 15 hours a week because of advances in technology and productivity through technology. Now, Peter was talking about technology and how it's done the opposite for us. It means we're on all the time, we're working all the time. So the technology sort of enslaved us rather than us have the technology release us or free us from the bounds of you know, long labour hours. And we have to ask why that is. And, you know, what happened in the 1980s? Well, we started to see a decline in the bargaining power of working people through the trade union movement. And so those declining working hours that they had successfully pinned to productivity gains over the previous 150 years or 130 years began to decline as that movement and as the labour movement lost the power to continue to say, well, if productivity is increasing and profits are increasing, an equal share of that should go to labour, should go to workers, either in more money or in shorter working hours. So I think that movement absolutely will have to come from working people saying, look, we want a share of the benefits of all this massive technological productivity and to have a bit of our work-life balance back and to continue that progress that we were making until the 1980s.
It's the where's my jetpack moment.
Peter, where's my jetpack? That's right.
One last question for you, Peter. Have we partly got ourselves to blame? I mean, we demand a 24-hour economy and services. We want instant customer service. Is work overload inevitable in that context?
I think that's the key question, because that's about taking responsibility, isn't it? It's about asking us to say, well, how much am I willing to give of my life to work and to actually living outside it? And that's one thing you can ask yourself. But then if you're the customer, it seems as if you want everyone else to be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thanks very much. So that's a really important cultural question that we need to grapple. And ultimately, it comes down to taking a personal perspective. How would I like someone else to treat me if I were in a situation where I had to be on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? I don't think anyone wants to work that long. So that's why it's really about thinking very clearly, where do we draw the psychological line about what is work and what is not work? Because you can have this effect of work spilling into your home life and then crossing over into relationships in other parts of your life with your family and your friends.
And we're all so very familiar with that concept.
It's a great question.
Peter and Emma, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary.
Thank you.
Professor Peter McElveen from the School of Education at the University of Southern Queensland, and Emma Dawson, Executive Director of the think tank Per Capita.